about this.
These two
people.
I am geeking out.
To the Geeks Unleashed podcast.
Mark.
Jasmine.
What a nerd.
Nerd alert.
Unleashed.
Television.
What are you talking about?
Anything can be a podcast.
Video game.
Geek.
What is a geek?
Oh, hi, Mark.
The whole point is, of course, the plot is.
You guys have great conversation.
I am geeking out.
Unleashed.
Movies. People love movies.
All right, you guys, podcast time.
You're listening to the Geeks Unleashed podcast. Part of the BCP Bad Batch. We take our passions and our fandoms and we turn them into conversations with you.
Hello, welcome to Geeks Unleashed. It's episode 157. I'm Mark.
I'm Jasmine.
Each week on the Geeks Unleashed podcast, we bring you, we catch you up, on our pop culture lives, and we bring you a review of something adapted from the comic book or gaming world.
Yes. And before we get started, if you watched it on YouTube, thank you so much. We appreciate that. We'd also love it if you would like this video and subscribe to our channel. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, we appreciate that as well. We'd also love it if you would leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podchaser.
Also, please feel free to donate to our Ko-Fi. All donations are greatly received. Thank you.
Yes.
Right, so this week's Geek of the Week. Jump straight in.
Geek of the Week. I mean, it's not that it's really anything to be excited about, but like everybody's been talking about it. Quiet on set. That's my geek of the week.
I was going to say, just before we jump in, geek of the week is something that me and Jasmine have done separately. However, Jasmine's one we both watched. So I'll let you kick it off.
Yeah, everybody's been talking about it. It's the Quiet on Set. It's a four part so far. There's another part coming out in another month or so. Duck on HBO Max. Oh, no, excuse me. I'm sorry. Max. It's just Max. But it's about Nickelodeon and all of the awful, horrible things that went on behind the scenes for some of, people that were younger than us. Because I feel like the series starts with All That. And All That was like one of the last big shows on Nickelodeon that I watched. And then kind of I aged out of Nickelodeon. And so a lot of the stuff that they're talking about happens after All That. So it's like the early to late 2000s. And it's just horrible. I mean, it's awful the way that these kids were treated and abused. And like, I don't know, it was a heartbreaking and frustrating watch. Especially because minors were involved, the records were sealed, yet the kids still had to go back to work, like after these awful things happened to them, you know, and still like be expected to show up and do a good job. And like, it's just like, that's mad pressure for someone that's 15 years old to be abused and then have to go to work with your abuser. Like, It was really hard to watch, but it was like an addicting watch. I waited and watched all of the episodes. Oh. Yeah, it was tough. And then just to kind of see the fallout of it, like that kid went on and then he of course had like alcohol problems. He had all kinds of other problems going on. And it was just like, he filed for bankruptcy at some point. And it's just like, I don't know, like you abuse a kid and then that kid's life is never quite the same. And then you get to go on working. And like the guy in question only served 16 months in prison and he admitted on tape what he did to that kid and still only got 16 months in prison and then was right back to work with children in Hollywood again. As soon as he got out of prison, he went straight from Nickelodeon to Disney. And I was just like, unreal. It is so unreal.
When I watched it, I think afterwards as well, it just made me realize like these people, I mean, obviously they highlight pedophiles, but they also highlighted just bad behavior in general of managers or showrunners. And essentially, if you make these people money, they just allow you to carry on.
Yep.
You know, doing these unspeakable things and or treat, you know, some of it isn't necessarily, you know, prison sort of sentence, like the showrunner, I forgot his name, Dan
Schneider.
Yeah, so he didn't do anything probably arrestable, but you know,
but he was a prick.
Oh yeah, I mean the way he treated staff was horrendous. Just you know, paying them to do jobs like, I don't know, I'll give you $10 to catch that fly, or I'll do $30 to do this or whatever.
Yeah,
and also just the way he would speak to the female staff, or constantly asking the female staff to give him massages, and just how it, and also like getting two female staff to split their salaries. And,
yeah, I don't even know that. Like, that is so not legal. That is so not legal.
But a lot of these people are so desperate for their big break in Hollywood, essentially, that they'll do all these things because they think it will lead to probably get a role like his down the road. But I imagine he was probably such a gatekeeper that he never would have allowed them to get out that high.
Yeah, and it was pretty apparent though. He did not really like women. Like, because he didn't treat the male writers that way, you know?
Ugh. But I watched that show like you did, and it's just horrendous, really. I remember hearing about a character, or an actor who, I don't remember his name, but he was the guy in Jurassic Park, the one at the beginning, and gives the shaving foam thing to hide the samples in.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, I heard that he got arrested for, I think, some sort of child pornography or something.
Ugh. Awful.
But if you think about it, he was a nobody, really, in Hollywood. And I thought about this only after the show. He was kind of a nobody, got arrested. I don't know how what time he did or whatever. But I don't think, from what I remember, wasn't particularly protected. But then you've got other people that were involved in Nickelodeon that were so connected, you know, with some huge names. The fact that he only did 16 months, that guy, that was that voice coach, because of his power and his connections and all the rest of it. And then he walks out of prison and, like I say, just ends up working back in kids' TV again.
Walked right out of prison and got a job at Disney, working for the Disney Channel. I was just like, this doesn't make sense. Like,
I do think there was an aspect of it. I thought to myself, I wonder if there's some of it is because in America, you're so much bigger and things are so much more widespread. Whilst I know they're in the same industry, I guess things are a lot more widespread. Maybe that can be under the radar. And I don't know if you guys have the same checks over here. Like, we have checks for anyone that has to do work with children or any vulnerable nature.
We have those. Okay. And like, he, after his trial, he had to register as a registered sex offender. Like, he had to register himself. That was part of his punishment. And he still got a job. With working with children. I have no idea how that works.
They not do those checks though. I mean, or maybe they do now. Maybe they do now, but
it's been around for quite some time. And it was definitely around in the 2000s when he was convicted. But it's really sad. Like, and it's everywhere. I remember when I first moved to LA, and we had some friends that graduated ahead of us, and they had been working in the industry before we got there. And we went to a party once, and somebody was just like, don't ever work at this studio, because if you work at this studio, you're going to end up working with this director, and this director is the worst person on the planet. We were like, no way. But like, it still happens. It's still going on. Like, that, I mean, that, nothing like to this extent, but even when I was at New Line, there was one of the executives that literally, because I was an intern, she told me I couldn't go to the bathroom on that floor because I was an intern. I had to go to the bathroom on another floor. And I was like, there's 17 floors in this building. What do you mean I can't go? I can't go to the bathroom on the floor where I intern at? Like, you want me to go? It was bizarre. But like, there's so many people in Hollywood that are on these power trips. And for what reason? I have no idea. I have no idea.
I feel like over here, I mean, I know a lot of stuff has come out even in the UK, but I feel like because things are a bit smaller, they work their way out event like probably quick more quickly than they do over there. I don't know, I could be wrong. It's just a, I feel like that's just an observation on my part, but I could be completely wrong. So
it's all about who you know, and that's the unfortunate thing. But like, why would you want to be the kind of person that protects a guy like that is the question. Like, what kind of, and like, it was so creepy to me because one of the kids was like, yeah, we were at a party at his house and like, he had this picture of a clown and on the back, it was,
oh, that, yeah,
it was a message from John Wayne Gacy. And I'm like, one of the most prolific serial killers in American history. And you guys are pen pals while he's in prison. Like
that was so super weird.
That should have been a guy, like a gigantic red flag for anyone. Like, that I don't ever want to be friends with anybody that is pen pals with a fucking serial killer. Like, I'm sorry. No, thank you.
Oh, sorry. I've got something I need to tell you. I just couldn't, when I saw that, I was just, I can't even imagine the mindset
right. To
become pen pals. I mean, I maybe like if you were not pen pal, but maybe if you were researching something and you needed to understand the mindset of something, you might, for some sort of article or college assignment, might write to a serial killer. Like, I can get that.
If you are doing some kind of investigative journalism, like, yeah, sure, okay. Yeah.
But I couldn't get forming an actual relationship with a serial killer that was ongoing and then boasting about it. That was crazy. So, you know, I can understand someone like Wes Anderson, you know, hugely, was it horror director, writer? Yeah, I can understand if he was to say, look, here's 10 letters I've written to a couple of serial killers or, you know, whatever, just because I wanted to pick their brains, you know, for my, I probably would get all of that. But to be involved in kids' TV and have that in your room when you've thrown a party with children from, you know, Nickelodeon and probably some other projects as well, you know, hanging around. That's just bizarre.
It was
really weird.
It was so, like, it was really like, the watching those four episodes was like a train wreck. Like, I just could not turn it off. And then by the time the fourth episode finished, I was just like, I don't even know what to do with myself right now.
When I was watching this, I was like, Nickelodeon must be fuming that this show didn't make.
I'm sure.
They must be bored, but I can't see them actually doing anything about it, but I just think they must be fuming.
Yeah. And to think, like, there had been so many other things that had come out before. Like, Jeanette McCurdy, when she came out with her book, I'm Glad My Mom Is Dead. Like, everybody was like, oh my God, that's such an awful thing to say. And I'm like, okay, but like, did you read about how her mother treated her? If you were in that same situation, I'm sure you would have the same sentiment. But it's just, and it's, I don't know, it's...
And she referred to the showrunner, but didn't give him by name.
No,
which obviously was, creator, showrunner, whatever, yeah. But she wouldn't say who it was, but everybody just was like, well, it must have been Dan Schneider.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes me so curious. Like, I want to know what the successful kids have. Like, what does Miranda Cosgrove have to say? What does Kenan Thompson have to say?
Well, this is where things still haven't changed, because all of those bigger names are still protecting themselves rather than going out there and going, yeah, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing, though. That's a really shitty part of it. Like, they have to do it that way because they have their careers at stake. Because if you speak out and you don't have enough people behind you, like the whole Me Too movement, that was huge, right? So many people came out that it was possible that they were able to take down Harvey Weinstein for all the despicable things that he had done. But like, if it's just one or two of you, like, that's not enough backing. Like,
that's they could the thing easily
crush two careers, no problem.
That's the thing with this show. When I was watching it, I thought, to me, it just feels like they've got all the sort of, I guess, celebrities, without being horrible, the ones that didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying something, but like you say, the Miranda Cosgrove, the Ariana Grandes, the big names, you can't tell me they didn't know stuff like this was going on,
if it was happening to them. And if that's the case, like, I'm not trying to out another victim, I'm not trying to do that, but I'm just saying, like, that I think it's telling that they are not saying anything. And I can't blame them, because like, if you went through all of that And now you have separated yourself from it. And now you have made a name for yourself outside of all of that drama. I wouldn't want to shake that up either. I would not want to put my career on the line for something that happened, you know, 20 years ago. You know what I mean?
Mm. You know what I said about, obviously the big world's a big place. This show, there's a lot of stuff I didn't even know. I didn't even know about that. Was it Jeanette McCurdy, her book? I didn't even know about it. I knew she didn't come back for iCarly. I knew there was some disagreement there because I know that the Sam and Cat show got cancelled. But I thought that was because she did something that they didn't like. I don't know, but maybe there was more to it behind the scenes that we don't know about. So
it's wild. It's so wild. And like the whole Amanda Bynes thing, I just think it's so awful what happened to Amanda Bynes as well. Like, she had so much promise and so much potential, and she just was preyed on by like all of these adults in her life. And it's just a really shitty thing. Like,
I actually looked up her account after watching the show and I was like, wow, she looks so different on Instagram. Yeah. Like, she's got like face tattoos. And,
yeah. Well, she, like, I mean, that part is a little bit on her too, because she was dating a really like shitty guy, and like that guy got her into drugs, and she never quite recovered from that part. But still, like going through that kind of trauma at like 13, I mean, ugh. And it really just sucks because like she did have such a promising career, and now she's posting about retaking her manicurist exam that she did not pass the first time. You know what I mean? Like,
well, she's clearly not going back into TV. I think last time she did something, it was like 2010 or something.
It's crazy.
I don't know.
I mean, but it's been happening forever, because like you look all the way back to like Drew Barrymore and Corey Feldman and Corey Haim, like all of the shit that they went through when they were child actors. Like, it's the same shit.
Clearly, well, they did say this in the show. They just see children as dollar signs.
Yeah.
And I remember that's still even going now, really. There's, yeah. What's his name? The star of Riverdale.
Archie? Oh, no. No,
the actor, not the character.
AJ Kappa.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. So I remember reading an article about how I might get the details slightly wrong here, but he fell asleep at the wheel after leaving set. And because obviously he's the star of the show. So what I remember reading an article and comments and stuff afterwards saying, because he's the star of the show, he's the one who works the most amount of hours, he's in most scenes, so he's probably got longer days than anyone else. And they were saying, really, the CW should do a lot more to protect those people. You know,
they should have drivers. Like, well, honestly, yeah, there's absolutely no reason you shouldn't be chauffeuring those guys from set to their place.
Oh yeah, like, so, you know, or putting them up for the night on, yeah, even if it's, you know, studio apartments, you know, on set or whatever. You know, if you're working a, you know, 20-hour day, which some of them probably are, and then they're having to drive themselves home, no wonder they fell asleep at the wheel. I just think this industry clearly doesn't do enough to protect the people behind it, which I'd never really thought about it until watching this show. And I would imagine it's probably still the same now. So,
oh yeah. And like the really frustrating part was like, not only were the people on set failing these kids, but like some of these parents were failing these kids. Like they were so concerned about not wanting their kids to be upset with them. Or like they were so focused on like their kids' career that they put their kids' lives at risk. And like there was one kid who was like, yeah, you know, my relationship with my mom was never the same because she always spoke out on set. And I feel like I got punished for her speaking out. But like it was really frustrating when they were talking about Drake Bell's mom and how his dad basically begged her, was like, look, If he doesn't want me to be his manager anymore, that's fine. But whatever you do, keep him away from this guy. Yeah. And his mom couldn't be bothered. She was just like, I don't want to drive him all the way to Hollywood. And on the one hand, okay, sure. Like, I get it. That's a long drive. Like, Orange County to Hollywood. It's an hour in no traffic. But, like, it's your fucking kid. It's not...
Oh yeah, what's wrong with them as well? Then they're letting a 14-year-old sleep around a 30-something-year-old.
Yes! Who does that? My parents did not let me go to my first sleepover until they had met my friend's parents and the parents of the other kids that were going to be at the sleepover. And it was also 2 blocks away from our house. So my parents could walk over anytime they wanted. Like,
when I was watching that, because it all came out because he was around his girlfriend's house and I forgot the guy's name, the voice coach.
Brian Peck.
So Brian Peck kept bringing the kid's phone, and then he obviously was feeling safe, I would imagine, in his girlfriend's house. So I think, yeah, clearly he didn't want to be continually raped or whatever was happening to him. So he was like just ignoring his calls. And this guy was such a loony that he then started ringing the house. And this is obviously the power he, I assume, he thought he had. And he just kept ringing the house. And in the end, the mum was like, this doesn't seem right to me. You know, a 35-year-old ringing up a 15-year-old, but not just once, 20, 30 times.
Yeah, obsessively.
So when I was watching it, I was like, that's so bizarre. Like, I can't understand a world where, okay, let's just say, for instance, I work in an industry where there are children. Like, yeah, I don't, but let's just say I did. Like, the only thing I could think might relate to is something like catering. If I worked in a hotel or something and there's a mixture of ages and we were all going out to Disney World and there's like 20 of us going and I say to the guy, you know, who washes the dishes, who's 15, do you want to come to Disney World with us on Saturday? There's 20 of us going, variety of ages, 14 to 50, male and female, whatever. Yes or no? That's all I'd want. Yes, okay, I'm coming, cool.
Yeah, you're not going to call him 40 times.
No, or he goes, no, I'm not coming. Okay, cool, no worries. And then I said this out loud, and I was like, well, yeah, but you're not a paedophile. That's why it's like, yes. It's a quick yes or no. Like, and I just thought, I can't understand the mindset. And then, okay, we'll take away the paedophile thing. If this was just an adult to another adult, let's just say it's a male to a female, it doesn't have to be a male to another male, but to ring them up 30, 40 times, that's some bizarre mindset there.
That's some real entitlement right there.
Yeah, entitlement, controlling, stalker, you know, crazy. To be honest, it's just, for me, it's a yes or a no. Okay, if it was like a mate, I really wanted to come for a beer. Do you want to come out for a beer? I'm not feeling like it. I'm like, oh, come on. And then if they then said no, I'd be like, yeah, okay. And but that's a different relationship, though. That's a me to someone of my own age saying, right, come for a beer. I don't know.
What bugs me. It's like, there's not a normal, like, non-celebrity parent that would do that. There's no flipping way you would let, and not just like stay, like, this guy is single. He's not married with kids. Like, if he was married and had a family, that'd be different, because it's like, oh, well, if you're going to go over to the house, like, maybe you're going to be hanging out with the kids. Like, why on earth as a parent would you leave your child in the care of a single 40-year-old man for a week at a time? It's bizarre. It's bizarre. And why did the ex-girlfriend's mom catch it immediately and his own mom never noticed? One of the infuriating parts.
Maybe she did notice. But there was money coming in the door. So anyway.
Anyway, quiet on set. Y'all should watch it if you haven't.
Yeah, quiet on set. I mean, what I like is that they don't go into any detail, but I remember what's his name, the actor, the child actor?
Drake Bell.
Yeah, Drake Bell. When they said to him, he obviously was very uncomfortable, and he's like, I'm not sure what I should say. And the person behind the camera said, well, whatever you feel like saying. And then he says, look, whatever you think the worst thing that could possibly happen, it's that. Like, and so he doesn't go into any detail.
Well, he didn't have to. They flashed
a report on screen. No, I know. I didn't want him to go into detail. And I I think he kind of summed it up in whatever you think the worst thing is, that's it. And I thought, I don't really want to think about the worst thing that a 30-something-year-old man did to a 14, 15-year-old boy. Just bizarre, bizarre. Like, I mean, obviously, I'm not expected to understand the mindset of a paedophile, but it's just bizarre.
Yeah, it's like, and it's shitty all the people that came to that guy's defense.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that as well.
And some people have pulled back, saying like, oh, I didn't know what I was really signing up for, yada, yada, yada. I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with that, unless his lawyer was shady, because when lawyers request a letter or a character letter, they have to tell you what the charge is, because they kind of guide you through what they want you to say in the letter. And I think that's one of the reasons why all of those letters had very familiar, like very similar text. But like, they still have to tell you what the charge is. And I just can't imagine you looking at that charge on paper and thinking, yeah, I'll write a character letter, because that can't possibly be true.
I just can't imagine an actor, and some of those actors were big name people, putting their name to it if they knew the full details. I just can't see that happening.
It happens. You know why it happens? Because usually those records are not unsealed. That's why. And that's exactly why there was all that fallout with Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis for writing that letter on behalf of Danny Masterson for his sexual abuse charges, because they wrote it under the presumption that no one else but the judge is ever going to see it. But after a case has been settled or sentenced or whatever, then it becomes like someone has to do is put in a request for it. Like, then it becomes public record. So it's private while the case is happening, but after the case has ended, then that, if someone requests the information, the judges have to let them see it, or the courts have to let them see it. So it's like they write it under this idea, like no one's ever going to read it until someone does.
I didn't know about that. So, well, yeah, like you said, it's a it's a documentary about the shady life of television.
Yeah.
And
anyone who is a child of the 90s that watched anything on Nickelodeon, mm-hmm. you would definitely recognize some of the faces.
So I don't think any of those shows I've ever watched that I didn't care about kids' TV, I think, really, in the 90s. Well, maybe the X-Men and the Spider-Man animated series, but that's about all I can remember, if I'm honest. I probably started to watch more slightly older shows around that time. But I know some of those shows, though, my kids did watch.
Yeah.
So my geek of the week, I'll try and be a bit quicker, is a British show on ITV called Unforgotten. I've watched all 5 seasons over the last 2 weeks. Each season is 6 episodes long. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't actually know anything about it. I knew it was a cop show, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I started episode 1, and it was, they uncover a dead body in a building. And then I realized, actually, this is a cold case show.
Mm.
And I would say there's an element of formula about it. Each season begins with them discovering a body in a bizarre location. And one of the ones I loved the best was when they found a dead body in the middle of the motorway. So, you know, you've got that gap between the motorway. You know, normally you've got the barriers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's the same in America. You've got, like, you know, your barriers. And there's some roadmen were doing some repair work in the road, and they uncover a dead body that's been there for 20 years. And when they eventually do find the killer, they asked him why he put it there. And he's like, I just thought I'd see if I could get away with it. And so he did for 20 years. But each season, it's really clever. What they do is they show you, so you obviously have the main police team that do the investigation. And then they show 4 or 5 different possible suspects, and they're all in different parts of the UK, or, you know, one might be in London, one might be in Brighton, or the last season, one person was in France. And each suspect, no doubt, has something that they did wrong. So there's, you know, whether it's one person, in season 5, one person was sort of got caught for upskirting, you know. And so, I mean, I heard that term.
Upskirting. What is that?
Okay. Taking a picture on your phone up a girl's skirt.
Like, what a perv.
Like, and, but each person's done something wrong. Like, and there was another, in a previous case, there was someone who had basically murdered a child in their car, basically dangerous driving. Then there was someone else who, I think there was a vicar who was stealing from his own church. But basically, they're all done something that kind of makes you like think, is that the killer? There's so many like, but it's written so well. And I tell you what, every season I've got it wrong. Like every season I've got it wrong. And
when you don't get it right?
Well, I thought even in season 5, I thought I finally got it right, and I guessed the killer. And then right at the end, there was a twist about it afterwards. I was like, oh, it's wrong again. it is a bit annoying. And I don't normally watch British shows. But I thought this was actually really well done. I don't know if people like cold case shows, if they like to watch a British show. And you can tell it's quite low budget. But, well, I mean, I suppose it's not low budget for a British show, but it's quite low budget.
By American standards.
I mean, you guys put a lot more money into TV than we do, but I just thought I'd highlight that. For me to watch 5 seasons over 2 weeks, when it came to an end, I was like, oh, what do I do now? Well, let's bring this Geek of the Week to the close. I think we probably spent a bit too long here. And we'll move into our main feature, which is going to continue our X-related content. X2 from 2003, so long ago now, right? Directed by Bryan Singer, and screenplay was Michael Dougherty, Dan Harris, David Hayter, Zach Penn, and Bryan Singer, based on characters from Marvel Comics.
Yes, and it stars Patrick Stewart as Charles Xavier, Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, Ian McKellen as Magneto, Pomke Janssen as Jean Grey, James Marsden as Cyclops, Halle Berry as Storm, and Pat Quinn as Rogue, Rebecca Romijn as Mystique, Brian Cox as William Stryker, Alan Cumming as Kurt Wagner, and Sean Ashmore as Bobby Drake.
So first appearances, some of these we mentioned last week, but I'll just quickly shout them out again. So Magneto, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Xavier's first appearance was in X-Men issue 1 from September 1993 by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Wolverine made his first appearance in The Incredible Hulk issue 180 from November 1974 by Len Wein and Herb Tribby. I think that's how you say his surname. Anyway, Storm made her first appearance in Giant Size X-Men issue 1 from 1975 by Len Wein and artist Dave Cockrum. Rogue made her first appearance in the month I was born, actually. Avengers Annual 10 in August 1981 by Chris Claremont and Michael Golden. Now, the new ones that I've added on here, William Stryker's first appearance was in X-Men God Loves, Man Kills.
Love that title.
That was November 1982 by Chris Claremont and Brent Anderson. Jason Stryker's first appearance was in Marvel Graphic Novel 5. It's a really generic title.
Yeah, very generic.
Came out in 1983 by Chris Claremont and Brent Anderson. And Pyro, he made his first appearance in Uncanny X-Men from Uncanny X-Men 141, which came out in January 1981 by Chris Claremont and John Bryan as well. So most of those characters are 80s and older. So.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So release date was 24th of October 2003 for this movie. Sorry, 24th of April 2003. Running time of 134 minutes. Budget was around $110 million. And box office was $407 million.
It did better than the last one. The Fox was so impressed with the results of their first X-Men film that they were like, all right, because they kept that first budget real low on purpose because of the failure of Generation X. And with the success of the first X-Men film, they were like, okay, we'll give you another 25 million. So they ended up actually giving them more like 50 million, 50 million more for their budget for the second film. But like, I just feel like you can't make big budget movies like this on $100 million anymore. Like, all the big budget films now are like upwards of 250. I think that's crazy.
I guess that's inflation.
I don't know.
Well, inflation, but I also think the actors are asking for more.
Well, depending on the actors, yes. Yeah, I can see it. But it's interesting because like you would never be able to make this big of a movie on $100 million nowadays, which sounds so just absurd to say, like, oh, $100 million, that's not enough. We need more money. All right, so fun facts. I thought this was really kind of silly and fun, but like 2003, the early 2000s was when a lot of those like flash mob trends were happening, like in the 2000 era. So the sequence at the museum in the beginning of the film, when the mutants are on a school trip and Pyro and Iceman and Rogue get into like the scuffle with these normies, and Xavier comes in and he freezes time. So that sequence, it's not CGI. They're actually actors or extras that are just standing very still, but they hired mimes.
All right.
And I thought that was so funny. And the reasoning obviously behind it was they're very good at doing that already. And so most of, maybe not all the children, but like most of the actors that you, that they actually pan to in that sequence where everybody just stops moving, most of them are mimes. And I thought that was freaking hilarious.
I did not know that. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. So at the time, in 2003, when this movie came out, it became the third biggest superhero film ever in 2003. And the two that were above it, Spider-Man, which came out the year before, and then Batman from 1989, were the two highest grossing superhero films before or ahead of X2. Obviously, most of the first wave of Marvel kind of blew all of those out of the water. But back in 2003, this movie was a big flipping deal. And then casting. So this one was interesting to me because I had not heard this, but Neil Patrick Harris was really like pushing himself for the role of Nightcrawler. And obviously he didn't get it. It went to Alan Cumming, but the only reason, not the only reason, but the reason that Alan Cumming got it was because he actually speaks German. And so because he was a fluent German speaker, Bryan Singer was like, you are going to be a perfect Nightcrawler. So that's how he got that part. So, okay, now this is a movie we've talked about before when we were doing Daredevil, but we talked about Geely and how that was a terrible film. Well, it turns out before J-Lo was in that movie, Halle Berry was in Geely, but Halle Berry got the call that they were doing X2, and she was like, never mind, I'm going to go play Storm again. And so she left Geely and came back to reprise her role as Storm. And also, she was just coming off of her Oscar win for Monsters Ball. And because of that, the studio went back and rewrote some of the script to give her more lines in this film, because now she's an Oscar winner in their film. And so they were like, she needs more screen time, we have to do something. Because that entire sequence between in Cerebro, where Magneto, or fake Cerebro, where Magneto is saying his goodbyes to Charles, originally that arc in the comic, Magneto saves Xavier instead of someone else, but they switched it to Storm and Nightcrawler again because they wanted to give Halle Berry more to do in this film. So they changed that comic arc story to the way that we see it play out in the movie instead. So after this movie, I guess this is like the whole let's play multiple Marvel roles. They almost got Hugh Jackman because they offered him the role of Frank Castle in The Punisher. And he was like, nah, I'm good. I'm playing this vampire hunter dude named Van Helsing. And so he chose to do Van Helsing instead of Punisher. And I'm not, I don't, I mean, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's bad. I don't know. Like, I just, I'm not sure. I'm undecided on if that was a good decision or not, because I like both of those movies, but neither of them is very good. So I don't really know, like, if that was a good choice. But also, because the filming schedule was so tight for Van Helsing and for X2, the sequence at the very end of this film where they're in the president's office and they're talking about the Mutant Registration Act, yada, yada, yada. So that sequence, they actually filmed it in London, where Hugh Jackman was currently filming Van Helsing. And the director and the producers for Van Helsing were like, we will give you Hugh Jackman for one day. You have him for one day. And so, like, they flew everybody to London to film that sequence in the office. And I saw something that said, like, if you pay attention, Hugh Jackman's Wolverine hair is bigger at the end of the movie. And it's because, like, his Van Helsing hair was really long. And so, like, his Wolverine wig didn't sit as tight on his head because his Van Helsing hair was so long. But yeah, so they did all that to fit Hugh Jackman's shooting schedule because he was already filming another movie when they had to film that sequence. Also, we almost had a Nick Fury cameo in this movie. But again, Fox and Marvel couldn't get it together and they couldn't agree on the licensing. But my question is, would we have gotten Samuel L. Jackson as Nick Fury, or would it have been some other guy playing Nick Fury?
I mean, probably someone else at that point. But,
yeah, I think so. It would have been too early. That's what, 5 years? Well, it's probably at least 3 years before they even started filming Iron Man.
That would have been amazing if they could have got Nick Fury in there. Well, I suppose by not giving up that license, because Fox would have sat on that, unless it was a one-time deal. Mm-hmm. But if it was, oh, we're buying the rights, then that would have really thrown off the eventual Nick Fury coming in.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, like, did they already have that long game plan when they said no to the licensing?
Probably, because the Iron Man film only came out in 2008.
Yeah,
so they probably had that as an idea. If this came out in 2003 and Iron Man came out in 2008,
yeah,
then there may not have even been a script written, but they may have had an inkling of what they wanted to do.
Yeah, I think it might have already been, like, in development.
So, yeah, there's no way. And why would they want to give up? It sounds like that would have been a really good idea and amazing. Yeah. Can you imagine how that would have gone down? I don't know what their overall plan would have been to have had Nick Fury. That's quite interesting. I'd like to know what their plan would have been.
I know.
You know, were they going to try and link Daredevil, Elektra, and X-Men? And because I know there was talk of Sony and Spider-Man and Wolverine doing something, and there are some photos online of I think I saw them years ago, of some potential crossover or something mm-hmm. or other, but which that would have been amazing. So I don't know, were they trying to build their own thing back then? But
maybe they were. Maybe they were, and they just didn't have enough licenses to do it.
Yeah.
I don't know. The world may never know. I don't know. If any Fox executives ever want to come and talk to us about it on the podcast, we're happy to have you.
Yeah. Right, okay, so let's just start breaking down this movie. Summary from IMDb. When an anti-mutant colonel, William Stryker, kidnaps Professor X and attacks his school, the X-Men must ally with their arch enemy Magneto to stop him. That's actually a good summary, if I'm honest. So
fairly accurate, I'd say.
Yeah. Right. So in the last couple of episodes, we've touched on what our knowledge was on mutants and X-Men. So you can go back and listen to the last two episodes where we talked about where we came across the X-Men and the episode before that where we came across Generation X. So go back and listen to that. We won't go over that again.
Yep.
And then kind of overall thoughts, but also if we'd seen this film before. Do you want to kick it off?
I saw this film opening night in theaters with a bunch of friends in college. I distinctly remember being so flippin' excited when you saw that shadow in the water at the end. That was a fun experience. I think, I don't know, there's something so fun about, like, just the midnight showings. Like, nothing kind of compares to that. Like, that atmosphere has always been so much fun to me. So that's how I saw it for the very first time. And I've seen it, I don't know, 20 times since. It's been several years since I've seen it recently, but for a very long time, this was like my favorite X-Men thing. Like, I liked the first film, but this one I thought was a really good follow-up. Like, it did a good job on building on all of the things that I liked from the first film, and then having that bigger budget, making it like more of a blockbuster than the first movie was. So I love it. I loved it then. I love it now.
Yeah. Do you know, when I rewatched this last night, I do remember, I don't know if I saw it opening night or the following day or the first weekend, but I did definitely watch it within the first couple of days of it coming out. And it was a packed cinema. I got a feeling it was during the day. And I still remember this. So, you know, the scene at the beginning with Nightcrawler?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Where he's trying to attack the president and he's in the White House. When that first opened up, when I was at the cinema, it was like someone had left the cap or something across the camera in the cinema. And it was like this weird, really dark fog across the screen. And a few of us were, I remember, like, it was getting a bit vocal in the cinema, going, is this what it's meant to look like? Like, you know, confused why they would open with such a really dark tint across the screen. And in the end, some guy near the front, he got up and I saw him walk out the door. And then a couple of minutes later, suddenly the screen was really clear and then we could actually see what was going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never forgotten that. It was a weird experience for... I've never had that before or since, to be honest. I don't know what happened with leaving across the camera or something. I've seen this film loads of times. I can't even tell you how many. And for a long time, this was one of my favourite superhero movies. I prefer this one over the first one. Whilst I do like the first one, I definitely prefer this. I would say one of the things I liked about this one more was the breakup of the movie, in terms of there's so many different sections to the film.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the first one, to me, it felt too quick. It was, I don't know, just this one didn't feel as quick. Maybe
much longer.
It's slightly longer, but I like the fact that we've got some scenes in the school, you know, just not normal scenes, you know, evening scenes. We've got, you know, Magneto's rescue. We've got some White House scenes. We've got them, you know, on the run, eventually, or obviously ending in a battle. But I like the fact that even, you know, we've got the bit where they're all camping one, you know, in the evening, and all the interactions with Magneto and Wolverine and Mystique. I don't know. I love the fact that we've got so many different scenes. I don't know. It just, I like, you know, the following with Iceman, that we had so many smaller scenes of him,
mm-hmm,
that are actually quite impactful in terms of his character as well. So, I don't know. I love this film. I think it's a really good, strong superhero movie. And like you, when it ends with the going across the water and you can kind of see the Phoenix under the water, I was like, yes! I was like, the next one's going to be the Phoenix saga. And I remember watching it on the animated series. I was like, that's where they're going. This is going to be phenomenal. When this ended, I was so hyped up that we were going to get the Shi'ar and the, you know, all the space and the aliens, and we were going, and like, they were really going to build up to a really, like, magnificent.
Oh boy, how disappointed
ending.
Were you?
And I just thought, this is where this is going. They're going to do a true Phoenix saga movie. I was just like, yeah. So, well, I mean, we can talk about number three next time, overall, and honestly, I love this movie. It's really well put together.
Yeah.
My only real criticism, they did what they did in the last film. They sidelined Cyclops as much as possible. And for the leader of the X-Men, I think they might need to have a word with him about stepping up his game. He keeps getting taken out. But one thing I think is really stupid is that he keeps having to press the button on his visors to shoot his thing.
Yeah.
I just feel that should be another way of him doing it. You know, maybe he needs to grimace or something, you know, maybe like a little face twitch that triggers the thing. Like, I don't know.
I think if they were to do this now, like the technology would be there so that the glasses would be intuitive and they would know when he wanted to go like into kill mode or whatever.
Yeah. It's just because obviously the moment
he needs to call Tony Stark. Like Tony Stark needs to design him a new set of glasses.
Because the moment he was fighting and then he couldn't get his hand to press the button, it was like game over for him. It's like,
yeah.
Well, what's your weakness? I need to press a button.
Need a third hand.
Yeah. Should have, you know, somehow knocked the visors off. That would have been better. But yeah, what a crappy weakness. You know, Superman's got kryptonite, Cyclops has got, I can't press my button.
A button.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't press my button, I'm done for. So. A pretty shitty weakness. Green Lantern's afraid of yellow, and Cyclops can't press his button, and he's done. So, anyway, I love it. It's a really good film. You know, I was annoyed about the Cyclops thing back then. It's still annoying now, but yeah, maybe you shouldn't have written that letter.
We're disappointed in you, James.
Right, okay, so I love the fact that this is the opposite of the thing that we criticize most other movies for. The volume of characters works really well in a film where, you know, I don't know what the percentage is of the human population of mutants, but to make that believable, you would need a vast, you know, a large cast of characters that have abilities. They do play it fairly safe. They don't have any disgusting looking mutants hanging around. You know, they haven't got the blob or, you know, I know they had Toad.
He'll come eventually.
They had Toad in the last one, but he still was only a bit yellow. That was it, really. They haven't gone for any of the peculiar ones. Or the ones that would have cost a lot of money. So.
Because they were already spending all the money on Mystique, so.
Yeah, she would have been quite a high budget. If they had Chamber, which we talked about when we did Generation X, where his whole chest is like a furnace, that would have been a serious amount of money to spend.
Yeah. So
they would probably do it now, but...
Oh, yeah, now. Now, when film budgets are like $300 million, yeah, sure.
Also, they've got the technology to probably make that cheaper as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a volume of characters, and... Do you have a favorite at all or not?
I have a couple. So I definitely like Storm better in this one because they let her drop that accent. Because I like Halle Berry, but Halle Berry can't be doing no accent like that. That accent in the first film was terrible. So they just got rid of the accent, and that just kind of made her role so much better. But Xavier, honestly, like, he was so good in this one, just in like his tone and the way that he can kind of flip back and forth between like the mind control and like himself. I just love that he was always this calm present. I mean, he's always calm, but like, it really stood out in this one to me, his like how big of a presence he has. So I really liked him. So I guess that's two movies in a row now where Xavier was one of my favorite characters, but he was definitely a favorite. And then I think I also really liked Nightcrawler, just because I felt bad. Like, nobody ever just let him have his full introduction about being in the circus and this, that, and the other. Just like,
I was the amazing Nightcrawler.
Yeah, let him have his moment. Okay. Let him have his full circus introduction, please.
Kurt Wagner. When I was in the whatever circus, I was the amazing. No.
And I think like my favorite, like, throwaway character, no offense to these kids, was the Blinky kid.
Oh, with the TV.
Watching the TV. Yeah.
Yeah, I never sleep.
Yeah, he was cute. I liked him.
I mean, that's a pointless power though. Just changing the TV.
Well, I mean, maybe he can do other stuff that is like electrostatic thing. I don't know. I don't know. I did like that we got a little bit of Colossus, because I like,
oh yeah, yeah,
I like this quiet Colossus much better than the cheesy Colossus we have in Deadpool.
Yeah, that's weird to think that they've got, well, it's meant to be obviously the same Colossus, but yeah, this Colossus was pretty cool. It was disappointing that we didn't see him other than the school raid yeah. scene. So, no, he was pretty cool when he you see the metal come across his body and they're shooting at him, and that didn't go too well. I personally love Bobby Drake, aka Iceman, throughout this movie. Okay. I love the simple moments that he has, you know, blowing the ice down the beer for Wolverine. I thought that was pretty cool. I love the challenges that he has in his relationship with Rogue. Don't get me wrong, I'm a Gambit and Rogue fan like yourself, but there is no Gambit still. So
yeah,
he's the substitute. but no, I did enjoy seeing that. And I, you know, also I liked seeing the fact that him and Pyro and Rogue had a little friendship going on. Whilst I didn't particularly agree with them being, you know, idiots at the museum, I did think it was cool to see that teenage friendship thing going on.
Yeah.
And the other thing I liked was that they went to his house, his parents' house, and they'd set it up earlier in the film that he hadn't told his family that he's a mutant. And then later on, yeah, he's telling his family about it. And his mum's like, have you tried not being a mutant?
I know, what a stupid thing to say.
I guess you'd equivalent that now to something more realistic. Like, I mean, obviously mutants are real. You can imagine some parents, have you tried not being gay? Like,
yeah, you
can,
exactly.
You can literally imagine that coming
exactly.
out. Yeah, actually, I did give that a go. That didn't work very well. So,
and I hated his brother. Oh my God, I hated his brother. Like, what a piece of shit. Ratting out your own family like that. Like, just jealous.
Yeah. I've always been a big Iceman fan since Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. I don't know if you remember that cartoon.
I watched a Spider-Man cartoon.
Oh, like when I swear that was like a 70s or early 80s cartoon that got played later on. I can't remember, but Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was Iceman and I think it was Firestar or something. They were two mutants. It was quite bizarre that he had two mutants as his amazing friends. But I've always been an Iceman fan. I love Iceman. It's pretty cool power, really, if you think about it. Been able to create that ice wall that saved Wolverine with Stryker. Yeah, he was definitely one of my favorites. I also love Storm in this movie. I like the fact that she got a little bit more to do. So yeah, I thought that was good.
Well, Oscar winner Halle Berry needed to have more things to do in the script.
I still think she's really massively underused. So,
oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this still is the Wolverine show. But
This one felt very much like the Wolverine and Jean Grey show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very different than the first one. I honestly wish we had more Magneto. Like, I think Ian McKellen plays Magneto so well. As the elder statesman. I do like Fassi as young Magneto as well, but like there's just something about Ian McKellen and his older, elegant version of Magneto. I like it a lot.
Right, okay. So the structure of this movie, I think, is brilliant, if I'm honest. And it's like a flip from what we had in the first movie. So the first one was very much Magneto. Yeah, he wanted to take out politicians. It was a huge thing on him. He was trying to kick that war off between the mutants and the humans. This movie brings it the other way around, that actually William Stryker, a human, wants to bring the war to the mutants, which I quite liked. That it was a flip of the last movie. And not all of the pieces were obvious at the beginning. You know, we have Nightcrawler, a mutant, trying to attack the president with... His knife that had mutant freedom or something or other written on the side of it. And that was an amazing beginning, if I'm honest. It was a really, really cool action-packed scene.
Yeah.
And then obviously we've got the school, and then everybody breaks up and goes around separate ways, and eventually they collide at the end for the showdown with William Stryker. And what an amazing villain he is, as for a human. The damage
for a human.
No, no, for, like, you think, compared, like, you've got Cyclops that can shoot laser beams and Jean Grey and Professor X that could literally, well, only if you can push the button. I mean, now you probably would have Siri optic beam, something like that. Oh, do you know what? I just said that and my phone just woke up. So, right. Yeah, he definitely has some sort of AI, wouldn't he? So, anyway.
He
right, okay. But yeah, they all obviously come to the end. And William Stryker felt to me like a bit like Lex Luthor, if I'm honest.
Yeah, kind of.
A tougher Lex Luthor.
I do like Brian Cox. I think he is a great actor. I think he did as much as he could with the role, but I think that the version of Stryker that we get in Wolverine is a better villain. Just because, like, there was more meat to the story. Like, they really painted a better picture of how despicable Stryker was. Like, in this one, we get the feeling, like, obviously he's a bad guy because he wants to use these kids to experiment on the machine before he tries it on himself or whatever. But, like, you don't actually see him doing bad things, if that makes sense. Like, you just kind of, it's all, like, this impression, like, oh, you are the one that put the adamantium inside Logan. And like, you, obviously you went and you did all of these things. You went to the mansion and you took these kids, but like, you don't actually see Stryker doing anything bad.
Yeah, but he's getting other people to do it. So,
right. Yeah. So,
what's your thoughts on the structure of the film? And also, do you have any favorite or key moments throughout the movie?
I mean, kind of like you said, like the way that this movie is broken out, I think that is one of the reasons why it doesn't feel overstuffed, because you're not spending every sequence with 32 characters. So the way that they kind of split the film into different locations, and then you get to see events happening in different places before the end of the movie where everybody comes together. I thought that worked well with the size of the cast that we had. And as far as favorites, definitely the sequence where those guys come to the mansion for the kids. That was great. I loved it. I loved everything about it. The shootouts, the violence, the Wolverine killing people, like all of it. I loved it. and then I think, like, the first time I watched this movie, the scene at the very end with Jean and the jet and the dam, like, that was really impactful the first time I watched this movie, but it kind of lost its steam the more and more I saw it. So, like, it just kind of loses meaning the more I see the film. But, like, I remember, I think I got teary-eyed in that the very first time I saw that sequence. So I did like that one too. And especially when she starts talking through Charles, like, I know what I'm doing. Like, don't worry about it. I'm going to get you out of here or whatever. So yeah, I would say those two are probably like my two favorites.
Yeah, I can see that. I love that school scene at the beginning. I think it's really cool. I love the fact that we've talked about a large cast, and they have obviously the big names who are the prominent leads. But the thing I love about this as well is all the smaller ones as well, like Kitty, so Shadow Cat, who, when the school is getting invaded, suddenly she wakes up and falls through the floor and is running through the school. And that was a good setup, because later on Professor X says, well, how did you get those files? And he's like, well, I've got a kid who can walk through walls.
Yes.
So if they hadn't have shown that, people may not have remembered from the first film. She watched the same characters in the first film. So that was a good setup. And that's where it's clever writing as well. You know, that was in the middle of an action scene and it was amazing to watch. And however, it also played something vital to later on in the film. So when a writer sets something up really well like that, you know, hats off to them. And I also loved during that school scene as well that there's a mutant called Siren. Where she lets off her basically a banshee sonic cry. So I don't know if you know the character of Siren. She's actually the daughter of Banshee from Generation X.
Oh, okay. I wondered, since they had very similar powers.
Yeah, they've got the exact same abilities. And so Siren in the comics is in X-Force. And obviously she only has a tiny moment in this. But the impact across the whole of the mansion, you know, everybody, Wolverine, everyone's like holding their ears until she gets stunned or whatever and gets knocked out. So, but yeah, no, that school scene was amazing. I thought that was really cool. I loved the scene where they're at Iceman's house, but all the police cars show up and Magneto's there. And, oh, that's pretty cool as well. It's disappointing that he turned on them at the end, but I love the collaboration between Magneto, Mystique, and everybody else, like Jean Grey and Wolverine, and the fact that they all camp out that night before they go and rescue their friends.
Yeah,
I like the fact for a brief moment in time, Magneto is aligned with the X-Men to save the world. I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, to save the mutant world.
Well, yeah, okay, to save the mutant world. Well, yeah, the X-Men's priority is to save everybody.
Yes.
But Magneto...
Well, slightly different endgame, but yes.
Well, that their priorities were aligned, kind of. Enough for Magneto to be invested.
So. Yeah.
One of my other favorite moments was, again, it was good setup, this. Mystique going in, getting the files, and also the little Easter eggs as well, because Franklin Richards' name is mentioned and a few other people.
So it was Remy LeBeau?
Yeah, yeah. There were so many names came up, it was difficult to catch them all. But
and I like the Maximoff twins were listed.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that. But who obviously they are mutants too. Because a deal was done for another movie that we'll talk about. Right, so I like the fact that we got the files. Then she then found, because she was looking for where Magneto was, and she finds all the security guards that get to go to his plastic prison. And then she goes to the bar and meets the guy, whatever, and then stabs him in the bathroom with something. And you're not too sure what it is. And then when that particular guard goes to the prison, and Magneto's like, oh, there's something different about you. And he immediately knows what he loves.
That scene was really cool, yeah.
Yeah, when he pulls all the iron out of it, and it only makes like three tiny little balls, but enough for him enough for him to break his way out. And then he turns to the guard, don't ever trust a pretty woman, especially one that's interested in you.
Yeah, so true. That guy was like the sleaziest of all the guards.
Yeah, and, but that was just cool, that whole setup with Mystique getting the files, the toilet scene where she stabs him with the iron.
I bet she was just excited to film without her makeup, without the Mystique makeup.
Yeah, yeah. She had to play herself for once. Yeah. Well, completely herself. So. I was thinking about it. Mystique's quite a cheap character to have in a way, because there were so many moments throughout the TV show, throughout the movie, where they'll show one character like walking up the stairs, walk past a pillar, and then another actor carries on walking. I was like, Mystique wasn't even really there for some of this.
I think they realized with 9 hours of makeup that it took in the first film, they were like, we can't do this shit again. Like, when we're going to have her in here, like it needs to be impactful. Like if we can put her in someone else's body, let's just do that.
And I thought it was pretty cool that they really did follow on from the first one where she was, I've forgotten his name, the politician.
Oh, yeah, Senator Kelly.
Yeah, Senator Kelly, that she was still playing Senator Kelly. She'd taken over his life. And without her being Senator Kelly, though, she wouldn't have found out that Magneto was in that plastic prison.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were so many good moments in this movie, I'm not going to lie. And the end as well, I agree with you, where suddenly Phoenix, well, Jean Grey, a.k.a. Phoenix, is saving the day and saves everybody. And then you see at the end her in the water. It's like, yes, well. Oh, right. Is there anything you would have changed or cut or anything like that? I actually don't think there is for me. I'm pretty happy with it. My only change would be Cyclops. Just beef it up a bit. Come on. At least he wasn't as whiny this time around.
Yeah. Not much. I think like there were a couple of things that I didn't like, but Did I dislike them enough to actually want to change the film for them? I don't think so. So I would say like this one is pretty close to perfect as far as like within the scheme of the film itself. I there was just nothing like glaringly out of place. I'll say that.
I love the style of this movie. I love the production and the variety of locations. It's not all kind of in one place. I love the fact that, you know, we've got alliances that have been formed and changed.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that we've got backstory with William Stryker with Wolverine, but also William Stryker's backstory with Magneto and Professor X, and everything is just, yeah, it's just, I don't know, really well done. Yeah, the writing is done well done. But, yeah, they've got great setups from the moment it starts.
Mm-hmm.
They use all the characters really well, you know, and they're not afraid to use them sparingly as well. I know it is kind of Wolverine show, but you do get other moments with other characters that I think are really well done.
Feel like it's the Wolverine show. I don't feel that way about this one. I don't know.
I think there's an element of it still in that, I think, but not as much as the first one. The first one was definitely the Wolverine show. This one, they do pull that back slightly, and they give some space for Jean Grey and Storm, I would say, in this movie.
Yeah. So. I will say, though, if I could, I guess I'll retract what I said before. If I could go back, I would have more with Lady Deathstrike, because I love Kelly Hugh. Like, And this was like, I can't remember now if this came out before Scorpion King or after, but like, this was such a level up from her character in Scorpion King. But I loved her and just like the silent assassin. Like, she literally just had one line in the entire movie. So it would have been nice to have more of Lady Deathstrike.
Yeah, she was pretty cool. Right, just for comparison purposes, in 2003, the other superhero movies we got, and we've mentioned these before, to be honest, Daredevil, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, an animated one I've not seen, Batman, Mystery of the Batwoman. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
Not seen that one.
And Hulk. This is the...
Oh boy, that Hulk is terrible.
It's the Ang Lee director version that stars Eric Banner, just to be clear.
Hulk is so bad.
How do you feel this movie fits with all of those other movies?
Way better than all of them. I mean, I haven't seen the Batman one, but like, way better. Like, I love League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I do. But this film is way better than all of those films.
I'd put this one first, X2. Yeah. Then League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I mean, I'm not seeing
Batman.
I've not seen the animated one to have a thing. I mean, maybe. But then Hulk and then Daredevil.
Oh, I don't know. Can Hulk and Daredevil be at the bottom? Can they tie for worst movie?
Can't wait till we can do an episode on that Hulk movie. I still couldn't get my mind around when I watched that Hulk movie. What were they thinking?
Like, yeah, like, I mean, oh God, the CGI like dogfight thing was just
It wasn't even the CGI. It was just, I don't know, what was he going for? It was like, he was trying to go for like an Oscar movie or something. It was just... Right. Anyway, right. So other movies of note in 2003, which I feel it's quite nice to talk about what else was going on in the world. And
yeah, to give you some comparison.
In the pop culture world, yeah. So we had The Matrix, both of them, Reloaded and Revolutions. They released 6 months apart. Love Actually, which is a huge film from 2003. Bad Boys 2, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, Monster. It was a big year. It was a really big year.
And like the fact that that was the third Lord of the Rings, like it was hard to compare anything to that.
I think for X2 though, still in this, you know, in 2024, be as good as it is compared to when, you know, it came out in 2003. And there's a lot of those movies I've rewatched plenty of times, and to have the influence and the impact that it's had on pop culture and superhero movies from 2003, and also to go up against other names like that and to make the level of money it made is quite a phenomenal thing, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it did well. It held its own. It stood its own ground. I really enjoyed it. Like, and it aged really well, surprisingly. Like, rewatching it now,
such a low budget, I think it's aged really well. I don't think it's awful at all.
Yeah, but like, there's not as much. I don't know. There's not as much to pull from, right? Like, they don't have very much technology other than Cerebro. They don't have very much technology. Like, when they're in that old dam, it's all very antiquated stuff, which, like, if you went to an old dam now, it would still look that way because it was built one time and they never upgraded it, you know? So you don't notice the time change when you're watching this film now. Like, it does, this does not feel like this film is 20 years old. Not at all.
No, definitely not. And like you said, the thing with the mimes, they were clever about it because obviously they must have thought CGI wise, that's going to cost us a big chunk of budget.
Yeah.
But what were mimes? What did they pay them? $100 a day or something?
Extra budget. Yeah. You could pay what an extra gets paid.
I don't know what an extra budget extra gets paid, but it's not going to be a lot, I imagine. So
it's probably like not even $100 a day.
So. I mean, what, that whole scene probably cost them 10 grand versus what it would have cost them in CGI.
Yeah.
Would have been a couple mil.
2 or 3 mil, yeah.
Yeah. It's clever, though. It's clever that they've adapted. They've used that budget really well. Right, ratings. It's I always love this part where it's like, oh, what'd you give it? I don't know. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
I would say I don't think my rating has changed. Like, this movie was great then and I think it's still great now. So I'm it's 4.5.
I feel the same. I'll be honest with you. Some movies you're like, oh, in 2003 I would have given it this and 2024 I'd give it this. No, I'm gonna jump on that 4.5.
Yeah. Look at us. Really strong. 4.5.
It's a really strong movie.
Yeah.
Really well put together, really strong cast. And some of these people were kind of unknowns back then. I think really written well, well paced, well structured, good setup. You know, it was brilliant. And yep. What I liked was that this felt like a natural follow on from number one.
Yeah, it did things better. Like, we had a few more complaints about the first film, and I feel like this second film did a really good job of addressing the complaints, like, except for Cyclops. But it was such a strong follow-up, which is so hard to do sometimes. Like, because if you look at those other movies from 2003, you look at The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions, but neither one of those had the impact that the first Matrix film did. And neither one of them was quite as good as the first film, right? And the same kind of, well, Lord of the Rings might be a little bit different. Like, when Return of the King came out, not Return of the King, when the Two Towers came out, Two Towers is my favorite of the trilogy. I thought Two Towers was better than Fellowship. And that could be like another example of one of the few times where the sequel is better than the original. And I think this X-Men, this little trilogy that we're having right now, like, this second film is definitely better than the first film. It's a really strong sequel follow-up.
Hmm. This is what falls in line with things like Terminator 2 and Aliens.
Yes.
There's not many people that can say a sequel is better than the original. And this is definitely a sequel that's better than the original. I agree with you about the Matrix movies. They only got worse as time went on.
Yeah, and then that fourth one was just like, what are we doing? What are we doing now?
That fourth one annoyed me. That's just, I don't know. If we ever talk about The Matrix, we'll go into it. But I was about to talk about it. And I was like, no, this is X-Men 2. Yeah, really strong sequel. In fact, better than the first one. Deserves this grade.
Yeah.
I think next week we're going to have to talk about, unfortunately, in episode 158, we will be talking about X-Men The Last Stand, which came out in 2006.
Admittedly, when I watch X3, it's only going to be the second time I've seen it. I watched that movie for the first time and I was like, I'm never watching this shit again.
I have seen that film more than once, but anyway. Right, you can follow us on social media. We're everywhere. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, aka X. come say hello.
Yep. And you can get this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Google, Podbean, Apple, Spotify. We're everywhere. So please leave us a 5-star review and tell your geeky friends.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a good week.
Good journey.